Hello and welcome to our third annual Christmas special podcast. It is Friday.
Jing, 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 jing. That's jingle bells. Jing, jing,
jing, jingle jing, bells, jing. Jingle bells. Happy
ho,
Friday.
Ho, ho.
Christmas time is here.
Nice one.
I liked your song, Grace.
Thank you. It was improv.
It was supposed to be like one of those like blended things you hear on like a radio show where it's like a bunch of different sound bites all like mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I haven't heard one of those in a while. I haven't heard the radio in a while, I guess. Okay. We should trademark that or something. Maybe work on it first.
Yeah, I'm with Daniel. We got to work on it.
maybe work on it a little.
Well, thank you everyone for tuning in. If you are a new listener, welcome. Now's a great time to hit that subscribe button. If you've been around for a while and you're not already subscribed, then, you know, all you need to do to give us the best Christmas present is to just hit that subscribe button. And you know what else is a really easy, simple Christmas gift you could give us this year? Is to rate and review us, because it helps us out. It helps the podcast. It helps us get to new listeners. And while you're at it, go ahead and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Friday Flicks Podcast. And, you know, it's the end of the year. It would be great to have some emails and comments to read off when we do our final Pixar roundup episode, if you will. So go ahead, send us an email at jkentertainment247@gmail.com, because we're here entertaining 24/7. And what else do we do, Jimmy?
Friends and family watching and talking.
That's right. So today we're talking about the beloved Christmas film Love Actually. But before we get to the movie, let's see who's here to talk about it today. As always with us, we have Jimmy Anthony, and he is going to be David, the Prime Minister.
I had an uncle called Terrence once. Hated it. I think that was he was a pervert. God damn it. I knew this would happen. Oh, all right. I had an uncle called Terrence once. Hated him. I think he was a pervert. But I very much like you. There we go. I got those words out. I had to get him out quickly. You know, he's like a quick talker. There we go. Got through it.
Back with us today is Byron Anthony, and he's going to be Billy Mack.
Oh, you old flirt. This whole record is shit, and I love it.
He's a slow talker. That's much easier.
Yeah.
So drawn out now.
Cynthia Anthony is here, and she's going to be Karen.
There was more than one lobster present at the birth of Jesus?
Well, duh. Isn't that the what her daughter says
yes.
back?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's the dialogue.
Oh, good choice. Grace Anthony is here, and she's going to be Sarah.
Hello, my darling. Nope, not busy. Fire away. Uh-huh. It'd be a little difficult to get the Pope on the phone tonight. Nope. Okay. Yep, you got it. Uh-huh. Yep, no problem.
Nice. Yep. Yeah. Good. Daniel McCarley is here, and he's going to be Jamie.
Bellissima. Bonjour. Oh, she doesn't speak French either. Oh, okay. Oh, God. Please don't read the. Oh, God. Owen Firth is really hard, actually. I don't know. He doesn't have like a.
No, that was perfect. That was like exactly what his character sounds like.
Was it really? Okay.
Yeah, I think you did a good job.
I don't believe you, but okay.
I think you did all right. Splendid.
Me too, Daniel.
Splendiferous.
Tip top.
Okay.
Tip top.
And I'm
jolly
your
good,
host.
Jolly good.
There you go. I'm your host, Kelly Anthony, and I'm going to be Judy. All I want for Christmas is you. There you go.
What?
Yeah. That's what she says.
What you got?
She's like the stand-in body one with, what's his face?
Bobo.
I was trying to spread out the storylines, like I said. I looked up the Keira Knightley one, and it was like, She has this really long one, which would have been good, but I can't do the British accent very well, so I,
Well, you could try. You should try speaking in a British accent for this podcast.
Yeah, everybody else did.
I just tried to do one, and that all I want for Christmas is you.
Do a British accent? Really?
Okay, fine. I'll try this Juliet one. But you never talk to me.
Yes.
You always talk to Peter. You don't like me.
That's pretty good.
That's the best. You don't like me.
Just shut out your jaw while you say everything.
Yeah.
I hate her. I can't stand it.
Like Keira Knightley in real life or like the character?
All of it. Just Keira Knightley in
general. Okay. Well, before we get there, we are talking, yes, today about the 2003 Christmas hit, Love Actually. Never seen this movie. It follows 9 different storylines of people living in London during Christmas time in the post 9/11 era, which I feel like kind of has some things to do with the vibes of this movie. Anyway, so there's 9 different storylines. Some of the people know each other, they're somewhat connected, but the biggest through connection in all these stories is, of course, love. Some of them find true love or new love, and others tragically lose love. And for this podcast, we're kind of just going to talk through each of the storylines and see what we liked and what we didn't like about each of them. There will be some strong feelings about Keira Knightley when we get to her storyline. But before we dig into that, I'm going to turn it over to Daniel to talk about the box office and Oscar trivia for this movie. So take it away.
Oh, shoot. Okay. Well, all right. I can tell you this. It came out in 2003. As you mentioned, it made about $59.5 million in the U.S., a total worldwide of $244 million, which is pretty good. And it came out in November, came out over Thanksgiving, it's a Christmas movie, so it was like the first Christmas movie. $62 million in the U.K., so it actually made more money in the U.K. than in the U.S., that's without adjusting. So it was like a full-on blockbuster in the UK, and it was just like a more moderate hit here, I guess. No award season recognition really or anything like that. I guess it went on to have quite a long life. There are some strong opinions on this movie that developed over the years. I actually did not actually see it myself till this morning. So, I don't know. We'll get into it. I mean, I don't have a lot more to mention here. I mean, it came out the holiday season. It was competing in movies alongside Elf. A movie we've brought up before here, but Elf made a lot more money. Return of the King would have been the same season.
Oh, Return of the King, yeah. There's only ever a few like actual Christmas themed movies that come out, or at least ones that are big and successful. So even 2 in the season.
Yeah,
I remembered hearing that it had like critical acclaim, at least, if not. But it won the BAFTA award for best actor in a supporting role for Bill Nye. The Empire Awards are like the British Oscars, is that correct? The Empire Awards or no?
No, that would be the BAFTAs.
Oh, that's like the BAFTAs. Oscars. Oh. Well, Emma Thompson was nominated for best actress for the BAFTA award for this movie, but she didn't win. But Bill Nye won the BAFTA for this.
Okay.
The Empire Awards, they won three. They won Best Newcomer for someone. I don't know who that actor is, who he played. It won Best British Film.
I remember it being kind of like a sleeper, like a cult classic kind of when it first came out. Like, not everybody was all about it.
It feels like more people saw it within a few years. It feels like it should have been a bigger hit. I feel like it was a bigger sensation in the culture, I guess.
I remember it coming out and seeing it on DVD, so I guess it wasn't in theaters. But anyways, it was like a big deal amongst my friend group. We all thought it was really funny.
Right, because of the cast, the hits just keep on coming when you see that. Exactly. But like, it wasn't, even though those big names were in it, it didn't feel that huge in the regular like culture to me.
Yeah, not like Return of the King did, not like Elf did.
Or even those like dumb like holiday movies, you know, like New Year's Eve and freaking Valentine's Day. You know those dumb holiday movies that I'm talking about?
I think that might be actually one of the reasons why it's still like withstands somewhat the test of time, because like they weren't trying to be that big commercial thing. They were trying to.
And that those movies are just so pushed in your face with trailers and ads and stuff. And this was not like that.
No, it didn't have time. Yeah.
Talking about all the actors, I did try to look up some fun facts, and I guess the director or producer, I don't know, I can't remember the person exactly, but whoever, like when it came to casting this movie, oh, here you go. Yeah, the director, he purposely wanted to cast like well-known and up-and-coming actors. So, you know, like you watch this movie and you go, oh, look, it's January Jones. But like, this was like one of our first movies. And then the guy from 12 Years a Slave, Andrew Lincoln from The Walking Dead, you know, these were all like very first roles for them, which is kind of cool. And Keira Knightley, this was only her second film ever. And apparently
after Pirates and Bend It Like Beckham, if this was her, it may have been her second.
Well, she filmed. So
if that's the case, then
it was the second one she filmed. That's what it said. It was the second one she filmed. And apparently on the set, she told someone like, yeah, I just got cast in this Pirates movie. It's going to be really terrible, but at least I'll get to go to the Caribbean for a few months. It's like something she told somebody, which is, you know, funny.
That's good. Yeah, so this was written and directed by Richard Curtis, who had specialized in a lot of rom-coms. He did Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Bridget Jones's Diary, did all those. Yeah. Worked later on. Recently, he did the movie Yesterday, which was about like that movie, like what if the Beatles didn't exist or something. He was involved in that movie. On Steven Spielberg's War Horse. Bean with Rowan Atkinson. That's some of his CV. So that's who this guy is. But this was like his directorial debut. Like he got the full reins to make this.
And he wrote it. So this whole like movie was his idea.
Yep. He is the sole writer and director.
And that's what did he do in Notting Hill? He was just the director of Notting Hill? Or he was just writer the writer of Notting Hill.
That much more illustrious as a writer. The films I mentioned, he was a writer. This is like mostly the only one he directed.
Would you say this was the first movie that was like, let's take a bunch of different storylines and try to connect them? Because there've been other movies like that since this that I feel like aren't as good at that.
For like the rom-com thing, yes. Like the movies like Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve, like those were all copies of this. I feel
thinking about the interlocking
storyline thing. Yeah.
Like Crash
was a couple of years later, but like, you have to think movies like Pulp Fiction and Magnolia and that whole thing were well before this. And I think those even took the formula from somewhere else. So that like this movie didn't invent that like interlocking anthology thing.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that this movie, I don't know, started a new trend of it, maybe. I guess is one way to put it.
Well, it definitely, I think there are other movies, you know, before this and probably around this time even, that had like big mega casts where like the cast was a big part of like why anybody would go to see the movie. Because it has this person and that person and that person. But anyways, this one stands out to me as sort of, you know, the one I can remember the most.
Right.
Or sort of starting that. I mean, I know there are old movies going back way to the early days of Hollywood that did similar things. But anyway, just from my upbringing, this one stands out as a prominent one of those. Like Ocean's 11 being another one sort of around the same time.
I think, though, that like to what they were just saying about the casting, when this movie came out, was it really like that? Like, if all these people were still so up and coming.
Well, I guess
it was Keira by the time Knightley. And so it had,
I mean, Rowan Atkinson, Alan Rickman, even Colin Firth, Hugh Grant, Liam Neeson. These were pretty well-known people at the time. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Maybe Hugh Grant and Liam Neeson were very well-known. Emma Thompson had won an Oscar.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Alan Rickman.
I think Laura Hugh Grant Lee, was at, like, his top form. Probably. Was this before or after Notting Hill?
This is after.
Yeah, he was a superstar. Yeah,
this is like, this is like, this is like victory lap for him. Like, he's ascended all the way to the prime minister. Like,
yeah.
That's even the subtext. That, like, yeah, like, what Hugh Grant was like the king of rom-coms. Like, what else can he do at this point except be the prime minister?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into it. Again, this has 9 storylines. Apparently, on one of the fun fact things I looked up, there was actually 4 other storylines they cut out of the movie, which I'm like, I can't believe there would be more. I feel like there's too many already in a way, but... let's first start out with the storyline between Jamie and Aurelia. So Jamie is the Colin Firth character. Aurelia is played by Sienna Guillory. I don't know. I don't want to say it. I'm probably butchering that. It's not Gilroy. It's some Spanish name I can't pronounce. So Colin Firth's character, Jamie, is a man who is very in love with his girlfriend. They show sort of in one of the first scenes, and she's clearly not as it back into him. But he finds out that she's having an affair with his brother. Heartbreaking. So he decides to skip town and head to France, where he meets a Portuguese woman. Neither of them can speak the same language, so communication is very tricky for them, but they still manage to fall in love with each other. And that they have like one of the big like romantic endings of this film. So what did you guys think of the Jamie storyline, Jamie and Aurelia?
I liked it. I thought some of when they don't know the other's language moments and they're like saying the same thing or like saying complimentary things, I thought that was really sweet. So I think that Aurelia like could have been a little bit more fleshed out, sure. But I thought that some of the more endearing romance parts of it came from them too.
I agree. Some of the most sweet and, you know, quiet, probably intentionally moments come from them. It's almost like they just gave Colin, whatever his name is, like, you know, a vehicle to just like showcase his like delicate acting skills. You know what I mean? Those only on camera that you could capture those nuances and all the little micro facial expressions and stuff he has there. And she's great too. And she's so beautiful in that like European raw beauty way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that storyline. It almost could be its own movie, even though it doesn't need to be any longer. It feels like its own story to me a lot.
It's like similar to like character of Colin who goes to America. Like, I feel like they feel like really isolated.
Yeah.
From like some of the other like brother sister relationships or whatever.
I agree.
But what was I gonna say? I agree with you. I think it's a complete, it could be its own thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was so tender and beautiful. And the proposal at the end, you know, that beautiful Italian or you know, French restaurant, the candlelight, she's up on the balcony. I was just smiling, I got a little tear in my eye, you know. And also that's compounded with the wonderful, all the rest at the end, all the happy endings and even the sad ones.
But I thought that that storyline was very original, beautifully played, well written. Even at the end, when he proposes to her, he's been practicing French. The syntax of the words are all wrong. And that's in the translation. It's really funny because he says, I can't remember exactly, but I come to ask you of use, you know, something like that. It's not even altogether good Italian, but, you know, of course, what is the language they speak, which is love. It's so sweet. Very much like that storyline. It's winning it for me.
Yeah, I remember, like, they show the audience that he went to, like, a language class to learn Portuguese. But, like, the first time I saw this movie, when he shows up and then she talks back to him in English, is, like, so cute. I'm like, oh, they both went and they didn't even know. So I love that little bit at the end.
Yeah, and then she has that great line. He says, you speak English. And she says, just in cases. You know, this is, again, that really smart writing.
How just long did, what was the time frame in which he learned Portuguese?
A week.
Well, he probably learned
couple weeks.
He probably learned enough to say what he said in his proposal. You know, he probably practiced that speech he gave. You know what I mean?
I mean, when he first meets her, he has this really poor attempt at trying to speak some words in Portuguese, meaning that perhaps he had some very limited knowledge before this, those 2 weeks, and then just really dove in and learned. I'm trying to help him out here.
Well, he kind of knew French. And then when she says, oh, no, she's Portuguese, he starts talking in Spanish. And then lady's like, no, not Spanish, Portuguese. And so it's like he must
say anything after that. OK, I thought he'd try.
But I'm just saying he has like a general understanding of these other, you know, Latin based languages. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But I don't know if you spend like all day for a few days just trying to understand a language, you'll be able to memorize a proposal speech.
it's realistic enough. It's very silly. I mean, of course, the whole like realness of it, but yeah, it's sweet. And like, yeah, how harsh are we going to be on this movie about like how real or not like the various storylines and plot points are, you know?
Well,
I think if we're too harsh, we're missing the point of it, you know? But yeah, I was going to bring up, does anybody feel like, I don't know, somehow it's like, oh, like, how could you not want to marry this guy? He's English. Like, I don't know, like, she's a foreigner and he's English. And like, I don't know, like, what does he bring to the table? I mean, he's awkward and sort of endearing. And I guess Colin Firth is somewhat handsome. But like, I don't know. To me, it feels a little bit odd that she and her family are like, of course, you got to marry this guy. He actually likes you. Like, I don't know, just like that he holds some status above her because he's English.
I think that there's something to be said for like just in other countries having multi-generational homes. So because of that, like a young woman might not leave their home until she was married into her husband's household, you know? So like, that's kind of just an old trope to want to get these daughters married off and get them all squared away. I don't think there's like, I think you might be thinking there maybe would be like a tinge of colonialism or something, kind of like, why would you not want to marry this rich white guy? I do think that he is handsome enough all on his own to be marryable or fuckable or whatever, like desirable, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So I don't really feel that. I don't think it's skews sketchy to me. I didn't get vibes from it.
It's a little sketchy to me, but I think that like overall this movie is coming from like a cis white male's perspective, like sure, the whole time. Like,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if I throw my two cents in there, I want you to know that I find Colin Firth very charming.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And he's also like, yeah. You also have like a connection that it's like spoken, but not like.
Exactly. Right. And it was all those quiet moments that they had together, really, that made this all, you know, like work, right? Even though they can't speak to each other, they just shared the time or whatever.
Right. I do agree that Aurelia is just, you know, underwritten. I mean, she's just a device more than an actual.
It's funny because they have all that business with her family, her father and the sister too. That's kind of a little bit more fleshed out than maybe they needed to be, but she's not.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I like that observation. come to think of it. I mean, I love the love story, but it's certainly because of Colin Firth, I believe, and just overcoming the language barrier. But her character, I don't know anything about her. I noticed a huge difference in the way she was dressed in the very first scene. She had a long coat, a long skirt, like knee socks and flat shoes. And then even as she continued to work as the maid or the housekeeper, she got more attractive, you know? So it was became important to her. And I could see how they could really enjoy each other's little idiosyncrasies, or, you know, there must just been a lot of heat too between them. And then she jumps in the pool, in the pond after his lost pages, you know, from the typewriter. And that's a turning point. But I think that a lot of me filled that in. I really do. Because
yeah.
the part was not as, we didn't, there were many scenes where various women were crying and, you know, and so we got to get inside them a little more, but not her, not our beautiful Portuguese lady.
Yeah, I was going to say that something I like about this movie, and they maybe did on purpose, I think, you know, there's so many storylines and it's, they're trying to stay in like rom-com time frame. So they don't have enough time to flesh every character out, obviously. But I do like how in a lot of these stories, you do get to fill in the blanks yourself. And you also get to sort of like fill in what happens after the movie yourself. And people probably have different opinions on different things. And we can talk about that too. But, you know, do we think that these two live happily ever after? You know? Or yeah. Do you think this only lasts like
you want to go through that for every single storyline, Kelly?
I don't know. Maybe I wasn't planning on it.
Here's the thing. He like broke up with his girlfriend at the beginning of the movie. How long was he with his girlfriend before this movie started?
We don't know.
Presumably a long time. But he meets this like secretary or assistant who speaks a different language for like several weeks. And then he's going to another country to propose to her. That doesn't make sense. The only way that makes sense is if it's like a colonialist mail order bride type situation, which is weird because it's Portugal. And Portugal is not like a third world backwater.
Portugal Daniel, is I'm a, where like, Daniel, I'm about to say something really, really harsh, but you're also coming at this as someone who has never really been in a relationship.
Yeah, and I don't feel like this and movie like,
you're also not a, about what these you're are also like. Not a woman, but like as a woman and someone who's been in love and now married, you know, I've met people and been like that like swooning love obsession thing. Like it's not whether it lasts or not is different, but like it's not unrealistic that he would fall madly in love with this girl in 2 weeks. People do that.
Yeah, but proposing often. Marriage though.
Yeah, people do that.
Marriage.
You'd be surprised, Daniel.
It's not,
and I'm not saying I agree.
The longevity of it. He's saying you asked if they were going to live happily ever after, and he's like, "Let's look at his track history. It's not very good, so probably
it's sort of a red flag."
Yeah, lots of red flags,
or an orange one at least.
I like my the way I fill in the blanks though is that he really, really loved his girlfriend and would have been happy with her, but she didn't love him back and was obviously not a great person. You know, and he just didn't find that person that was going to love him back with his, you know, because there are certain guys like him that just like want to love a woman and have that person, you know.
Do you know him?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm making
Colin,
sense.
They just want to love a woman. He's got all this love in him.
Well, you know what I mean? Like some guys like want to be players like we have in this movie as well. All right, let's move on. Okay. Next storyline. We have Sarah, Laura Linney's character, and Carl, played by Rodrigo Santoro, who is her hot coworker that she's in love with. She's been madly in love with him since she first saw him 2 years, 7 months, 5 days, whatever she says.
I need someone to remind me who that guy is, what else he's in.
I don't think I after of anything else he's
oh,
in.
Oh, he's in something. Oh, my God. Oh, he's no, like he's... the villain. He's the villain in something.
Yeah,
he is in.
That one of you guys would be like, "Oh, you don't know? It's the guy from the."
He's in 300.
Maybe that's.
Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, he's not a villain in that, so I don't know.
I don't know if he is.
Isn't he like a model? Wasn't he like a model though? He's not really an actor.
Maybe. He's from Brazil.
Yeah,
300.
Anyways, so she is in love with him. He clearly is, well, everyone in the office knows he's clearly interested in her back. And they have a moment where they're going to do it, but then she just can't allow herself to not provide 100% attention to her mentally ill brother. So what did you guys think of this storyline?
Well, she's got to get the Pope on the phone.
Yeah, it's the most heartbreaking one, I think.
Yeah.
She's so, Laura Linney and Laura Dern are like American treasures. I was thinking about this Laura situation earlier, but
the Lauras, yeah.
So good and everything. And this is no exception. Just one more thing. We were also talking about how it's, you don't meet the brother or know that it's her brother for a long time. And it's pretty uncomfortable, right? Because you can tell that there's something a little bit like, it's a little too frequent, these phone calls, but she has like a lot of genuine care behind what she's saying. So you don't know what this relationship is. And it's obviously infringing on her life. You know, I just think that's a really interesting storytelling device to not let us in on that piece for us.
Yeah. And then she says, darling. So you're like, is she married? Is she, does she have a son?
Yeah.
She's right. Then babe. That's
true. They definitely intentionally mislead you at first.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say in the Laura Linney treasure that Grace said, I think one of the time, I think I maybe like rented this movie at Blockbuster or something, you know, because this was still came out in the time when that would happen. And I like to watch all the like extra features, I think is where I saw this, but it must just been the director who was, you know, wrote this and had specific people in mind, that he specifically wrote the role of Sarah for Laura Linney and was like, I want Laura Linney to play this character. So he wrote it for her too, which is just cool. But yeah, go ahead, Byron.
No, that is really cool. And it, you can kind of tell, like, she's just so good in it that that makes sense. But I was going to say, like, I thought that it was, you know, it's like 2000, early 2000s. And this movie is like commenting on on modern love, essentially. And I think that like one of the interesting things in this storyline is that, you know, not all love is romantic. So like even with Bill Nye, the manager, and his manager, it's like some of the love is familial, some of the love is platonic, but it can be like the love of your life doesn't have to be this grand sweeping romance. It can take different forms, and so I appreciated that
storyline and that guy, right? Like he loves her and they sort of come to a conclusion where he can leave it there, and that could be the love that it is, and that's all it is.
Yeah, and it even had that those first innocent childhood loves.
Yeah,
you know, so that's right. Any all the aspects, really.
Yeah.
And unrequited love, and you know, having it end badly, death, whatever.
Well, do you guys think that the Laura Linney character Sarah, like, was right to just abandon all other things for her brother at the drop of a hat, or do you think she should have done something for herself?
I mean, that's not really our call to make, because there's no.
Well, I'm just asking what's your opinion on it. That's all.
I think she followed her heart the best way. Boundaries.
And obviously, her life is suffering a little bit.
Yeah,
so say that again, Grace. Sorry.
I think that healthy boundaries are healthy boundaries, and like, obviously, I think to be her best self, she could probably use some stronger ones.
Yeah, but
I don't know her life and the interests, and it is her call to make. And ultimately it comes down to like day to day, what she's going to do. It doesn't really matter what's best, you know?
Well, you know, her character is fleshed out enough that we knew she was shy and not quite comfortable with herself. And so that's good acting too, to tell us that much without any direct dialogue. And so it made sense that she lived alone and, you know, but the mystery of who is on the phone was also, you know, that was very captivating.
Yeah, as far as her relationship with her brother, I think the movie does sort of leave it intentionally like, yeah, like, is this good or bad? Like, I mean, whatever, it's just love. It's just about their relationship and the love they share. But
you are kind of like, really though? Like, that is really cool that you're helping your brother, but like, I don't know. The movie, I think, intentionally makes you feel that way, sort of conflicted about it.
It like leaves a weird taste in your mouth, right? Like it's okay, but you're just
kind of. And it's very, very sweet that she loves him so much that she'll do anything for him. And you're like, wow, that is really important, but wow. I don't know. Yeah, it makes you feel weird about it.
Well, I think to Grace's point earlier about boundaries, like if she keeps this up for a while, she's going to crack like bad. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think I'm not saying she needs to create a relationship with this Carl guy, but she should have had sex with him for her, at least had that for herself, you know, at least that little moment to sort of recharge her and keep her going. But I don't know. But
do you think the movie could be saying like, like, this is more important than sex? Like, I mean, could it be, like, trying to say, like, oh, that's just flippant sex, and that's not love, and this is real love? Like,
no, I think it's intentionally great.
Yeah, I think so, too. I just thought I'd throw it out there, but I think so.
Not to get ahead of ourselves, but, like, the Emma Thompson and Alan Rickman storyline isn't, I mean, she says it's fine, but I think that's just as unresolved as this one.
And I don't want to jump ahead. I know we'll get there eventually, but yes.
Well, we can talk about that one next, which is one of the, I guess we keep saying fleshed out. It's probably like one of the bigger, stronger storylines. So the, so Harry and Karen are their names, the Harry, Karen, and Mia triangle. So Karen and Harry are married with children and seemingly have a good marriage, but Harry's new secretary, Mia, hits on him every day. And, you know, sort of tricks them into buying her this fancy necklace for Christmas instead of buying it for his
wife.
Doesn't
trick him.
I think so.
What do you mean? How does she trick him?
Well, I guess tempting is a better word. You're right, Jimmy. I just, you know, when I wrote that sentence out, when I wrote that sentence out, I was wondering what you guys would think about me using the word trick. Well, I do. I think she's like manipulating him with her sexiness and like, buy me this necklace. Like, what was that?
Maybe she's actively trying to get sexy with him.
Well, yeah.
So is that manipulating? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
I think both.
Kelly is saying she uses the word trick as a stand in for like manipulate, sexually manipulate, whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
I just feel like then is every relationship wherein somebody asks for a pretty gift and gets one a manipulation?
There's a subtext to this, though. They're not she's not just asking for a gift. Everyone knows that.
She's not like his actual partner, though.
I don't think she's trying to like gold dig him, though. I think she just wants to be with him.
I don't, Grace.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think she definitely wanted to be with him, but I always felt like there was a, because she thought she would have more power, you know, or just to win the conquest. I mean, I thought she was definitely playing him.
I do think that she was thinking like, it was sort of a game for her, for sure. I think she was attracted to him, like, and did want to have sex with him or whatever. But I also think that it's a game, and the way she was just doing it, just like so casually almost made me feel like she's done this before with other guys many times. And she got a fancy necklace out of it. And she might have done that with other guys too. And again, it's all up to our own interpretations, like we said too, but that's kind of the way I always looked at it.
It's also just another case of the female character being slightly underwritten and no one knows really who she is or what she wants. So,
Byron, isn't it interesting we just kind of gave her the role of antagonist right there? What about him? He had he wasn't paying attention to his wife, you know, he was obviously trying to, hoping to mess around with this or whatever. But it's complicated, of course.
I was thinking about her and like bringing up a conversation like, is there something redeemable about her? How much blame goes to the other guy? But at one point, she's literally, it must be in the context of a costume party, although I don't really understand why. But she's wearing like
company Christmas party
costumes, I guess. She's wearing devil.
No, she just decided, yes. No, so it wasn't like a costume party. She just decided to dress
really
that way.
It doesn't really make that much sense in the context of the story. It's just like, they're just like, yes, she's a temptress, she's a devil, that's who this character is. Like,
yeah.
which I kind of appreciate in a way that they didn't have to make it everybody nuanced, you know, maybe it makes that storyline simpler. They have so many storylines going on at the same time. If we were supposed to be feeling conflicted about who's tempting who, you know, that might have just added too much complexity to it.
No, I understand. They have to, like, they have a million balls in the air and they can't juggle them all the same, whatever. But I do think that, like, a sentence or two from her to explain her would have helped. I felt that way about Aurelia as well. So, yeah.
Well, they even have this one shot that Mom pointed out of, like, it's Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson doing something, and then it cuts to her, and all she does is take off her dress, and she's in her panties, and that's it. So, like, that one shot could have clued us in on a lot of her story. Really? That did. You know,
that scene was so gratuitous. Other people that were in their underwear or half naked had a reason. But this single kind of six-second shot of her taking off her dress and looking in the mirror at herself as if she's, you know, ever so proud, and then was gone. But, you know, but it was a very beautiful woman with practically nothing on. So, I mean, that seemed gratuitous to me, because the other scenes I felt were much more organic, and where and why and how people were half naked.
Right. Well, I feel like that could go to what I was saying about her character, that she thinks she's super sexy and she's into herself and she's like, let me see what I can do with this. I think, you know. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and go on to the Juliet, Peter, and Mark storyline. This is the Keira Knightley storyline. So Juliet and Peter get married 3 weeks before Christmas. Peter's best friend, Mark, seems to hate her, but she finds out something different. So what did you guys think of this storyline?
Keira Knightley's character is probably the most underwritten in the movie. Of all the underwritten females, this is the one that's like, what is she even doing?
That's interesting.
Yeah. I just feel like there's like nothing, like well, that's a theme that's going to keep going, but you know.
This story is so weird and like almost creepy and
like, okay. This is one of those like that really is the like you can't do what this guy does. This guy does a number of things that are not good.
Yeah.
Are we reacting positively to it, or are we
okay? Well, what things does he do that you think aren't good?
He like was hired maybe through money.
I was unclear on that. Was he hired, or just did he just do it?
No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't. Hey, no.
Either way.
He was not hired to make the video.
Okay, so he wasn't hired with money, but like still,
still to be there at the wedding.
To come up with a wedding video, and like he like almost deliberately sabotages it.
No,
and tries to pretend.
Daniel,
no.
What?
Yeah.
I hear your point, Daniel.
Interrupting you, Daniel. Go ahead.
So was the wedding video like either not planned or someone else was supposed to? And his footage was supposed to be like a backup, like, oh, we don't really have anything, but we know you happen to have a camera.
Exactly.
Was that more or less what happened? Oh, okay. I guess that makes a little more sense.
He made just like a private video as a wedding guest. And she just is like, oh, the videographer sucked balls. So let me just see what you happen to get. Maybe there's a shot of me in there.
Oh, I did miss that explanation. That like it does add some important context.
And that, what he does is film that just that. Her face and like her, the small of her back and stuff like that.
Which it would be creepy to see it unless, I mean, it's creepy to do. Even if you're attracted to someone, you know what? It's very romantic in a lot of ways, and it's a great device for this movie. It really does help you see her the way that he supposedly sees her, and it points out to me why they hired Keira Knightley, because gosh, her weird little bony like Barbie like body really does like catch the light in all these very like pretty angles, and like her jawline is so defined, and the way the little stream of hair like bounces against her like rigid jawline, like it's just like, okay, like they needed somebody who just like exudes like this kind of bridal beauty, which she did in that moment, at least the way it was shot, you know, and everything. So I just thought it's convincing that she was supposed to be so beautiful to him in that moment that he just had to film her. And the shots that they use really do highlight her beauty really well. But it's still creepy.
I think Jimmy has a crush on Keira Knightley.
I know. It sounds like it. That actually, yeah, that moment was the first time I'd actually seen her and been like, oh, yeah, she is really gorgeous, I guess. Because before I always thought she was kind of weird looking. Like you said, Grace, with her underbite kind of thing. And like just like too skinny looking. Anyway, I'm not trying to bash Keira Knightley, really, how she looks or anything, but... yeah, it was one of this viewing. I was like, oh, okay. She's pretty gorgeous in that moment in the little video.
Maybe. I do appreciate how, despite like how creepy that is and generally, you know, just like coveting your friend's wife is like that. The guy is still endearing, right? Like the way that he still stayed reserved and is trying to not speak to her and not have a relationship with her in that self-preservation style or whatever, like it makes you not just write him off as just being some weirdo creep, I feel like.
Yeah, and then of course the moment with the cards, which is like such an iconic moment. Mm-hmm. Pretty sweet, pretty tender.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, that was the actor's real handwriting apparently on the cards.
Well, whoever wrote that scene, it was so creative. It's iconic to us now.
I think it's that one writer-director guy did everything.
It's just so great. Well, and then, and also, you know, how he says, the very first thing says, tell him they're carol singers, you know, singers. And he has this little boom box and is playing the music so that the guy upstairs thinks, I loved all those details.
Yeah. I didn't realize until this time that, right after this moment, he walks away and it says, enough now. I'd never seen that before.
Yeah, in my mind, she ran out and kissed him and they were together forever after that. Like, yeah, I don't know.
Says enough for now. And they definitely parody that in other rom-com movies where someone will say enough for now. And it's they're like, what's the word, referencing this movie. Hmm. And it is weird.
I have no idea.
He says enough for now. Like, oh, is he gonna now go after her? Like, I don't know. But that's just where
periodically,
their
like,
ends.
Trick his friend and like hold little cards up. It's weird. It's so weird.
And then like the three of them are together at the airport at the end. Yeah, too. That's also weird. It's really unclear what the status of that whole thing is.
I think he gets over it. Is my take on that. I think he'll find something.
That's the happy ending.
I guess that's an optimistic view, but okay, sure.
Or is it just like a serial killer origin story, like episode zero of some Law and Order episode?
Law and Order. I don't know why that's so funny.
Just to piggyback on what Gray said, I think that. Yes, it's creepy that he took all those shots and everything. And he's the owner of that art gallery with like all those nude pictures of people, right? Where they host a Christmas party at. But he's clearly like an artiste too. Like he came up with the idea to do the cards, right? I mean, we know that that was written by a director, but like he's an artistic guy clearly. And he took all those very good shots of her on his camera. Like, I think it's that like also just weird artist thing. Some people have too, but to Grace's point, I think that he purposely didn't talk to her. He didn't want to try to get to know her because he didn't want to fall more in love with her and steal her away from his best friend. Like, I think he was trying to put those boundaries as best he could, but she found out finally. So he didn't want anyone else to, yeah, but it's not like,
I guess.
I mean, who knows what he does with her, but I'm saying it's not like he went up to her. It's not like,
but you're right. There's evidence of him,
though, you guys.
There's evidence of him trying to like put it behind him, or like, you know, not at least flirting with her openly. So it's not as though he's just,
I think that when he finally does the card thing, tells her how he feels, like he finally gets it off his chest. And to Byron's point, maybe they both unknow it and they have an understanding, but. He can still be friends with his best friend and they're still married and everything's fine. And to Daniel's point, that's an optimistic view, but I
guess
most of you try Wouldn't that be best case scenario as a human? You still want to have your friend.
Yeah, it keeps in the theme of, I guess, the rest of how these.
Well, what's the way you think it should have worked out then, Daniel?
I don't know. Like, I feel like she would totally awkwardly have no idea what to do in that situation. Like, I don't feel like she would run out and kiss him as a response, but that would be like really, really weird for her.
I wouldn't run out and kiss the guy who did that, but I think her kissing him is sort of like a thank you of like, thank you for telling me how you feel. And also like an I'm sorry kiss too. But I don't think that there was anything really romantic about that kiss. You know, I think she still loves her husband and isn't really interested in him at all. She just wants to be his friend.
Yeah. And I guess it's supposed to be, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like somewhat at least nuanced points about love. And maybe that's sort of partly what's happening here, that like love isn't just like always just like, well, you either love this person or you don't, and like you're either fucked up and like trying to get them to cheat with you, or you're like totally ignoring them forever, and like, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe they will have weird like sort of romantic tension going forward for a while, and maybe that is kind of normal, and maybe that kind of happens, you know, out in the world, you know, and like the complexity of love. Like, I don't know if they're trying to make a comment on that, but Maybe they are trying to keep it like kind of like, who knows? Maybe he still loves her. Maybe he'll super pursue her. You know, love is complicated. You know, maybe they're trying to leave it like that. I think the happy ending, though, that they really want us to walk away with is what you guys already said, that he's over her. They kissed. He showed her the cards and he kind of was like, ah, never mind. And now they're just friends. I think that's what they want us to kind of think.
That makes sense. That wasn't super clear, but I guess it makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to John and Judy. This is the Martin Freeman character and Joanna Page. Two body doubles for some movie with a lot of sex scenes.
Yeah, like a porn.
I'm seeing some people.
Is it porn? But wouldn't it just be the porn stars if it was porn, though? Like, they're clearly not actually having sex.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think it's stand-ins. Some that's people seem to think it's
for anybody, just to frame the shots and stuff.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's what I said. But I was saying like the body doubles for some movie. I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of sex scenes in it, or it's this one. Well, I guess it was just one day of shooting, maybe for them.
No, because it went across the weeks. But yeah, every single scene when they were at quote work, they were naked emulating sex. So they were stand-ins for porno for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Well, they're just at work, both totally naked. And they're just talking and getting to know each other. And then they end up falling in love. So there's definitely a metaphor here for them starting out with all their clothes on and they slowly take their clothes off. And when they first are with all their clothes on, they're like not saying anything to each other, you know, and by the end of it, they're totally naked and they're like, I like you, let's go out. And then they get married, and the airport scene at the end, it shows that they must be like going off on their honeymoon. I think they're like, look, we just got married. I think that's what happens at the very end to them. But like, you know, that's interesting. Like, I think it's an interesting metaphor. Like, look, just throw all clothes off completely naked. Tell me what you got and like just show your whole self to someone, and that's how you can fall in love with someone. I think is kind of what they were trying to say with that.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting that like the real like quote unquote sex scenes, other than the one with Sarah and Carl, I think is the only other real sex scene. But like there, it was like deliberately having nudity and sex, but with like these awkward situational comedic moments. I don't know. I thought it was interesting. It was like, seemed like deliberate that they tried to make like all the sex revolve around something either like kind of serious with Sarah or something like really funny. And there was no actual like quote unquote, like steamy sex scene. Mm-hmm. I think that like back when I first saw the movie, that sort of like awkwardness wasn't as like it was like probably pre most of the Judd Apatow stuff and like pre The Office and like the awkward comedy, like wasn't quite what it is today. So watching it yesterday, I was just like, it's not that funny. It didn't really like pop out to me as like one of the more funny bits of the movie. That's just me.
I think you're totally right. I don't know if it was just that we were younger, but, and like the nudity was more shocking and made us more giggly as a result. But like, it did seem that those scenes seemed to be so much funnier before. And it might just be that we're desensitized to that style of like awkward, yeah, awkward comedy that like sort of came from The Office. It didn't come from The Office, but like our exposure to it in America really blew up through The Office. And yeah, anyway, I think that's a good point.
That's true. I think that those scenes, like, I think some people could argue that their storyline you could completely take out of the movie and it, nothing would change. But I think you need them, like, with them just being naked and, like, acting awkward and ha 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 in, you know, comparison to the more serious stuff that's happening in the movie. I think it helps. Yeah,
I think you could take the storyline out, but I hope no one ever would because it's so very funny. And honestly, it's very original, you know, that this couple meets because they're stand-ins on behalf of the lighting designers and all the people getting ready to film a porno movie. And they're emulating sex every which way, up, down, sideways, inside out. And then they're having these very common conversation. I think it's such a great comedic device. I loved it for that.
So. I agree, Mom. I actually think it's a really like well-written storyline. It's just funny that it doesn't hit the same way comedically like it used to. But I agree. I actually think it is clever.
Oh, well, so Jimmy, remember, today's the first time I saw it. So it's very funny. Yeah. So it's not just in your memory or you were younger. No, it's funny. I mean, I could imagine that, you know, a few times you see it, it's not going to laugh out. I might not laugh out loud like I did today. But I really enjoyed it.
That also makes sense.
Funny.
Okay. Well, also themed with sex. In a way, and this is, we've got this Colin character who just wants to go to America because he realizes all British women suck and he wants to go to America to score some hot chicks. And he does. He scores 4 hot chicks. So yeah. This is probably movie, like...
I didn't mean to interrupt.
I would say like this movie is 2003. It's very of its time. It still holds up for the most part, but I feel like this storyline, if they made this movie today, would either not be in it or be totally different.
Oh, hell no. It better not be in it.
Yeah.
I was assuming there was going to be some kind of punchline. When he's at the bar and he's like meeting all the girls one by one, it's like, okay, what's the punchline going to be here?
Yeah.
And then there's no punchline.
I think I felt the same way when I saw the movie for the first time.
And then that's when I was watching that scene, that was then like the key that unlocked this whole movie. Like, oh, this is just like no stakes wish fulfillment, like this entire movie. There's no like real clever
That's
message.
Where the movie crosses a line.
Just wish fulfillment for the whole thing. And it's like,
because it's like, you're right. It does seem it's really like it's too good to be true. You're right. You're like, when is he going to wake up from the nightmare?
Right.
Sorry.
This is a dream. Like, this is a dream, right? That's one explanation.
Or like, all the girls end up, like, they all have boyfriends or something. Or like, they're all lesbians or something instead. But I think that, like, I had the same thought the first time I saw it. But, like, watching the movie now, having seen it a few times and knowing what's going to happen to his character, like, I don't know. There's something to be said for like, oh, that's fun. I don't know.
That's totally what it is. You're it's like, an oh, injection of sex and fun into the movie to make it. Yeah. I think on one of the movie posters, you know, I look up the background for our Zoom things. On one of the movie posters, that had the tagline, like the ultimate romantic comedy or like the best romantic comedy ever made or something like that. I think it was the ultimate. Anyway, there's definitely a lot of formulaic things they're trying to inject into this movie and check all these boxes, and they do it really well. And I do think sex was something they needed more of. And just that, like, you know, like, success kid meme, like, yes, feeling at the end of the movie, just like, where everything pays off, everything comes together is, like, a big part of, like, romantic comedies. Like, McLovin getting laid at the end of Superbad or, like, you know, the various things like that. The guy getting the panties at the end of, what is that, 16 Candles or something? Anyway, yeah, just like those little, like, you know, successes that I feel like they had to, like, just inject the movie with some of that. And then, yeah, maybe they were making a comment of, like, you know, this has all just been a fantasy or something. I don't know. It's very silly. It stands out from the somewhat realistic nature of the rest of the movie that it's just so over the top.
Remember, Jimmy, earlier we were talking about all these sort of boxes that love could be in, you know, short-term love, long love, significant, you know, love, sex for its own sake. Well, this is sort of, you know, that kind of love too. Love for a dream, young, you know, hot, going to the bar, finding the chicks. That is a part of all of us. You know, that thing, that urge. And so maybe I'm being too heady about what otherwise was pretty crass and funny, and know that you're not with that scene again. First of all, it's just, I mean, if he'd had one hot chick, that's one thing. But all of them and the silhouette at the end where they're all taking off their clothes.
Yeah.
Like, this is, now we're in a cartoon.
Because exactly, prior to the window and you're seeing that it's literally happening the way that they described and all that, like, he could be getting set up or tricked or something, and maybe we never see that, but it's just, like, clearly getting more and more and more too good to be true, more and more ridiculous. And then you're right, like, when you see it in the window, it's like, oh, this is a cartoon, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That like, some of the biggest fans of this movie that I know are, like, bros, and I wonder if, like, Colin had a part to play. They were probably trying to appeal to a wide market. You know, rom-coms are typically marketed probably not to 18 to 25 year old men, but Colin certainly is, and so they're probably just casting a real wide net market wise.
All right, let's move on to David, the prime minister, played by Hugh Grant, and Natalie. So David is the new prime minister. He meets his new staff and immediately is attracted to one of his assistants, Natalie, whom he ends up firing because he just feels uncomfortable around her because he's obviously attracted to her. What do you guys think of the storyline and, like, Hugh Grant in particular?
Well, hang on. One more thing about the storyline, though. He also fires her because the new president of the United States, you know, has come to visit the prime minister. He leaves the room, and when he comes back, it looks like the president's about to kiss her. Remember? So he's...
Yeah, but that's not why he fires her, though. He says it later when they're in the car. He basically tells her that I had to let you go because you made me feel so uncomfortable. But he's not, like, mad at her because of what the president did. It's the opposite.
I don't know about that. I think he does, like, because when she reached the car, he's like, oh, she didn't like him, and I am her person. So I think that, like,
because of that, too.
Yeah.
Huh. I don't think that. Because after that scene is when they have the, like, press conference with the president, and he, like, gets all tough and, like, stand up to the president. And it's all, what he says is all... He's mad at him because of what he did to Natalie. So he's, like, sticking up for her. Yeah, so I don't think he's mad at her.
It's also his ego, too, because he's been...
Well, true.
His ego's been bruised by, you know, this girl who like, big flirty vibes, and then all of a sudden she's making out with the president of the U.S., and he's, like, he's got a, you know, peacock's got to fly.
No, it didn't occur
to me. Well, they weren't making out.
Yeah, it took me a while
took it as the president just straight up hitting on her, and she's, like, scared and didn't know what to do.
Right. That's what that was my first interpretation as well. But I guess we're supposed to think that Hugh Grant thought she was into it.
Hugh Grant thought that she was into it.
Yes.
And then the card makes her... card tells him otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Again, another gray area, though, right?
Mm-hmm. True. I think Hugh Grant's really funny in this. And the scene when he's dancing around his house is great. And apparently Hugh Grant, like, didn't want to do it. He thought it was too stupid and silly.
Really?
But they were like, nope, you got to do it. That's what I read on one of these articles I was looking at, yeah.
It used to be one of my favorite parts of the movie. I really got a kick.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I loved him.
It's not anymore?
Oh, I'm just like... I don't know. Yeah. The fact that you told me that Hugh Grant didn't want to do it and thought it was stupid, it's like, I feel like that's why I don't like it. I feel like I can see that now. Or I didn't before. But it just seemed like he's like a little bit kind of like, this is fucking stupid. Like,
okay, well, can I read this blurb from this article?
Yeah.
It says, though Grant and Curtis, the director, had worked together on Notting Hill, Bridget Jones's Diary, and Four Weddings and a Funeral, they had a deep disagreement on how the Prime Minister should be played. Grant wanted it to be a grounded performance and resented Curtis's push to make the part more whimsical. This came to a head when shooting Grant's dance number, which the actor refused to rehearse. Quote, he kept on putting it off and he didn't like the song. It was originally a Jackson 5 song, but we couldn't get it, so he was hugely unhappy about it. We didn't shoot it until the final day, and it went so well that when we edited it, it had gone too well, and he was singing along with the words. It was a tricky thing to cut, but the final result with Girls Aloud's cover of Jump For My Love speaks for itself.
I mean, yeah. Don't get me wrong, there's a reason they kept it in the movie. There is, like, a certain, whimsy and charisma there, but I just didn't enjoy watching it this last time, that's all.
Oh, it's one of the best parts, I think.
Mm-hmm. You guys, I'm not familiar with the actress playing Natalie.
I'm not either.
Because she was so darling and perfect, and I didn't know if maybe she was a star from, television in the UK, or if I just missed the movie she was in.
It looks like she's done a lot of TV in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like she's probably bigger in a lot of that.
Okay. All right. Got a couple more left. We've got Daniel, the Liam Neeson character, Sam, and then Joanna. So Daniel's wife has just passed away, leaving him to care for his stepson, Sam. Sam seems really depressed due to losing his mom, but it turns out it's because he's in love with his American classmate, Joanna. So I feel like this storyline is one of the biggest hearts of the whole movie. And again, like we were talking about different romance, there's the love of a child, and it's also a relationship with a stepchild, which is really interesting that they had, because he could have easily just been his actual dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but the fact they chose to make him be a stepson, it makes it their relationship even more heartwarming, I think, in a way.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, no, it's actually my favorite relationship in the movie. It's the one that really captivates me more than any of the other romantic relationships, or even the caring for her sick brother relationship. It really captivates me. Sucks me.
Well, it's interesting because they spent so much time on the resolution of this relationship at the end. I mean, all the chase scenes through the airport, I could have been done in one or two shots, but he got through this security guard, past the passport people,
and then
down the hall and over the fence.
So I thought, when we were watching it, I was thinking this must be pre 9/11, the fact that he does that, but apparently it's not. It's kind of crazy to me.
I think that's the joke. The joke is that he's running through airport security in the immediate post 9/11 type thing.
Yeah, I agree. And who knows? He wrote. Actually, I don't know. I think that I was about to say maybe he wrote this before 9/11 actually happened, but I don't think that's true because. The whole opening scene with Hugh Grant's character, narrating the very beginning and the very end, he's referencing 9/11. And I think the fact, that they decided to shoot this at airports and that the airport was a big part of it, I think is all, a commentary on the post 9/11 era, I said earlier.
Everything that had every movie or TV show with an airport or plane, between 2002 and 2008, is wink, wink about 9/11. Okay, maybe not everyone, but most of them.
I don't think that's true anymore.
Not anymore, but.
Mm-hmm.
Well, something that was really sad watching this movie
reference
now is that Liam Neeson's character is dealing with the death of his wife. And that's something that really happened to Liam Neeson pretty publicly. Yeah, and he's talked about in his career. and why he's done so many action movies was because he was just trying to not focus on his wife passing away. I thought it was like, oh, it's like almost,
yeah,
it's like too ironic in a way.
I'd forgotten about that.
I never heard that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. His wife died in a tragically skiing accident.
Uh-huh.
And then he immediately, the next movie he makes is Taken. Mm-hmm. And it's like clearly, it's interesting that you think he actually admitted that in interviews, that he clearly took on that movie and like,
no, he did. Like, I heard that
action movies, because that was like how he was dealing with that his wife died.
I heard that in that he said that in interviews. That's why he literally said yes to almost every role they asked him to do after his wife passed away, because he was just trying to not think about her. Yeah, it's really sad. And I love Liam Neeson. He's also very charming.
I think he got canceled. He might be coming back from that, but
he got canceled.
Why?
He said some like not nice racist things.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, he's doing Star Wars
now
stuff
that
again.
You, now that you bring that,
is he doing Star Wars again?
Well, he was in the Obi-Wan Kenobi episode, and it was really him who voiced his characters for the Tales of the Jedi animated series they just released too. So he's cool. Officially coming back for Star Wars stuff.
He went on to Atlanta, I think, to talk about what he had said. Atlanta, like the Childish Gambino show, the Donald Glover show.
Mm.
He's coming back, but I think it was like also around the same time as his wife died, when he said like some shit that people were just like, dude, why did, what? Like, yeah, you could look it up, but yeah.
Yeah, I think his kid, I don't know. I guess it's cute, the two little kids like relationship, the Sam storyline, but it's also just like, I don't know. I don't care about it that much.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. I really enjoy it. I think being a kid who learned how to play drums, I guess there's a little bit of a connection there.
He learned
just like the scenes when he's learning
fast.
I know, it's also very silly. It doesn't make, it's like learning Portuguese. And
I think the thing, it's not so much their relationship. It's like the whole like singing scene is like, I don't know, also very rom-com and like Christmas movie. You got to have a musical number. But it didn't bother me that much this time. But like the first time I saw this movie, I was like not into the girl singing. I think because I just didn't believe it. But apparently that actress really did sing that. That was really her voice.
Oh, wow.
And apparently she got a record deal after this movie came out. I saw on one of the articles I was reading. Yeah,
got any of the royalties.
I mean, that's the version of that song that made so many people.
That's
know
true.
About it,
I
right?
guess that's true.
I would
maybe,
think this
maybe
movie
that,
really
you know, maybe
catapulted
it's because I just don't
that
like
song.
That song. I just
maybe
like
that's
that
just my.
It was more it was gradual. It's probably a factor.
It
you're
definitely
right,
catapulted
probably,
it, but it's Mariah all the way, that song.
Well, yeah. It's Mariah, of course.
But it definitely brought it back on the scene, for sure.
Yeah, like certain movies get a big, or songs get big boosts from movies, and this would be that, That's what's going on here.
All right, let's move on to the final storyline. Billy Mack, played by Bill Nye, and his manager, his fat manager, which we don't ever know his name. They just always refer to him as the fat manager, I think. Billy Mack is a washed up rock star trying to make a comeback with a Christmas album. And he finds out that his one true love is his manager in a bromance kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely my favorite storyline of the bunch. Mostly because of Bill Nye's acting. I think he's like,
yeah, Bill Nye's the best.
So funny in this part. It's hard to imagine anyone else playing this character and anywhere near as good.
And the song is playing, and I'm like, this is supposed to be funny, right? This is supposed to be like funny how bad this song is. Although
like,
I do
this
like
is shit, right?
I do like that this storyline went into the whole thing about the Christmas number one in the UK, which is a thing, because the music charts in the UK are much more of like, I think, publicly reported, or the mainstream media reports on it more, and people like, there's a history of people deliberately getting together to like buy certain singles and game the music charts and stuff in the UK way more than it happens here. It's interesting that movie brings it up. Like that's the one on a show that I think is based on Top of the Pop.
Do they still do that, Daniel? Cause I just felt like that storyline, that element of the storyline was very like 2000 early 2000s, you know, mm-hmm. sort of the end of getting to the end of the you go buy music era. Like now everything's streaming.
Right. Yeah, well, definitely. this is like the early years of American Idol and that
That's
whole thing
true.
Too.
Yeah.
So like that was still going on at that time. And like yeah, iTunes was about to happen. So
it was like just about to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I like how this storyline like is the one that everyone. What am I trying to say? It's in all the other storylines because they all are watching him on TV or listening to him on the radio and they're all seeing him too. And I just like, I think that's pretty funny. And they're also laughing at him.
And that's like his only connection to anybody else is just that they see him on TV.
They all see him on TV, yeah.
But he's the through line, like you were trying to say, Kelly, for all
yeah.
of them.
Yeah. But yeah, he's hilarious. And I just think it's funny how he's just like, it's a terrible record, but we're trying to beat out Blue, which I apparently was also a commentary on... Well, I read in an article. I don't know if this was just this person's viewpoint or if the director really was just making this commentary on like pop bands and boy bands like taking over. Because I guess that was the era of that, like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. Yeah.
You get that, that message. Yeah, I don't know. The music is pretty bad, and it's kind of annoying, honestly, when it's happening in the movie. You're just kind of like...
I feel like this movie has a pretty good soundtrack, though, some of it.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. The soundtrack in general. I'm talking about the music that Bill Nye's character makes and sings.
I feel like the way this movie is written is like a Broadway musical. And, well, I had that thought just thinking about, like, the way the scenes are composed and the way that they feel and this, like... pathos of the romances and all that. But I think that what really makes me think that it's a musical is that there's so much music in it.
Yeah.
Like from the start, they're playing and singing songs and talking about music, and like the soundtrack, even when it's like not happening in the world of the movie, is driving so much of what we're feeling. So it really reads like a musical to me.
That's super
I honestly
true.
Think I was thinking about the Laura Linney dialogue. That reads like such a play to me.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, they're making all of these rom-coms Broadway musicals now. I wonder if they'll ever do this one.
Yeah.
I'm probably surprised they haven't.
At all, yeah.
Someone probably tried and it didn't do well and it just never did anywhere, but I'm sure someone tried.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like it could be a good one. I mean.
It honestly, like, it has all of the makings. It's like, a musical that they decided to make into a movie instead of a musical. Yeah,
because of the actor thing or something.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to also allow a moment for us to talk about the Rowan Atkinson character.
Oh, my God.
The annoying gift shop rapper who also shows up in the airport at the end.
Did he wink at the camera when he was at the airport? I felt like he did.
Did he?
It feels for a second like he winks at the camera.
He doesn't wink at the camera, but he definitely gives a look of like,
it's weird, but because I remember thinking to myself, that's weird, like because the other eyes had no purpose to be at the airport, you know.
Well, yeah, he just slows him down long enough so the kids can make room.
Well, no, he's getting on the plane, but he's like, oh, I need to find my ticket, and he's like distracting the plane flight attendant so that the boy can run onto the plane, and then he's like, oh, I must have left it in my other jacket, and then he like gives a weird look like he knew, like he's been aware of everything all along, almost like I did that on purpose so that this little boy could run by, and like I purposely was fucking with that other character at the mall so that he would get caught by his wife, like.
Yeah.
And like, oh, I don't know. That's just a fun thing to think about.
Mr. Bean knows all.
Yeah.
He's actually Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's fun.
Father Christmas.
Yes. He should be.
That would be a good episode if he had to do the Santa Claus duties.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so those are all the storylines. Now I want to, I know some of us have already said like our favorite, least favorite, but I just want to do a quick like wraparound and you'll say your favorite scene, or no, we're going to start with least favorite scene. So not like storyline yet, just like, is there a scene in the movie that you didn't like at all, you feel like shouldn't be in the movie, or you could do without? Who wants to go first?
The entire Colin storyline can go, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think Grace, that's, I agree. That's one of my least favorites. I also hate watching the beginning of the scene where Keira Knightley sees the video with like the pie and he's like kind of sheepishly trying to not show it to her. It's just kind of, it's a little bit of that secondhand embarrassment, and also just feels so like, you just know that we're going to get past it. So I just want it to be over. I just don't like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Jimmy?
Those are both such good picks. Damn. Yeah, the Colin thing, you're right. It's like so not necessary for the movie at all. Like the whole storyline could be erased. So that's a really good point. I might just go with that.
Okay. Daniel, do you have a least favorite scene?
Least favorite scene? I actually don't know if for an individual scene. Maybe like the scene in Portugal.
Oh.
At the Portuguese restaurant.
Like the very end? Well, yeah. That's very Daniel. It's very Daniel to say he doesn't like
it. Yeah. It's very,
it does
like,
seem kind of far-fetched. It's just like,
it's very like, look, again, Portugal is not like, yeah, it's like, the, whatever. That's probably
but
my least
but
favorite.
They're not in Portugal. They're in France.
Oh, is it France? No, because it's like,
and also
no, they're in Portugal.
So you can speak Portuguese in Brazil.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't think it's super clear. I mean, it shows what airport he goes to, but I don't know airports well enough to be like, oh, that's
it was. It was in Paris. It was a French.
Well, he was on his retreat in France.
Yeah, but then he goes back. And I thought that the name of the airport looked like it was French, though.
Yes.
Maybe.
That's why I think the whole thing took place.
Her family could have moved to France from Portugal together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
they're not all speaking French.
It's possible, but.
Portuguese.
Whatever. Cynthia, do you have a least favorite scene?
I think I mentioned it early. Oh, God, now I'm forgetting the character's name, but you know. Our temptress, that scene where she looks at herself in the mirror and, you know, you see her take off her dress and she's in the perfectly matching darling red panties and bra. This is after the party, you know, where she flirted mercilessly with him. And I thought that's a dumb scene. It has nothing to do with anything. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
It's just another way to show a pretty body. You know, when the others were much more authentic.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. I agree about the Colin stuff. Like, I do kind of like the scene when he finally makes it to the bar and he's with the girls, because I think that they're being pretty funny in that scene. Apparently, another fun fact, January Jones apparently improv'd all of her lines. And she like actually gave like suggestions as for what should be happening in that scene, which is kind of cool. I do like when he finally makes it to the bar, but all the other scenes of him just complaining and like, I got to get to America. And he's like not an attractive actor, which they probably kind of did on purpose. I'm just like, I don't care about you. Like, you're not attractive. Get over yourself. Like, that's how I feel on all those scenes. Okay. Favorite scene. And we mean, I'm talking about scenes, and I would like you to stick to scene. Don't say storyline yet, because there are some really good scenes in this movie. So Byron, I guess we'll start with you again. What's your favorite scene or part of the movie?
Favorite part of the movie is actually like this brief little joke that they do when Colin Firth's character is going like to the restaurant. And like, as he's walking down, the town's like getting bigger and bigger. And they're like, this English man's going to go turn Aurelia to a slave.
Yeah. I knew that line you were going to
go kill Aurelia. And he's like, cool.
He's all into it.
Yeah, it's like all the storyline keeps changing as the crowd gets bigger. Yeah, it's pretty funny. Yeah, that's good. Grace, how about you?
I like that last scene in Portuguese, like he's talking about, but I also feel like there's, I don't have a specific moment in mind, but I feel like Emma Thompson has some really beautiful moments in there. Mm-hmm. Some really like true, just messy, the gray area of it all that we've been talking about. Maybe the scene when she asks him, like, what would you do? Like, if you found your husband's jewelry or whatever, I just really like her in this. So maybe that one.
It's a good choice.
Okay, Daniel.
Favorite scene. You know what? For scene, I guess I'll go with Rowan Atkinson, who like
at the, when he's gift wrapping,
like a whole thing. That's a scene. I'll give Rowan Atkinson the best scene.
Okay,
for me, he's good. That's.
Okay, Jimmy.
Yeah, wow, Daniel, I think that's the right pick. That is probably my favorite scene. Because Alan Rickman is also so good in that scene. It's just like the straight man. Just like
yeah.
Trying to get... Anyway. But I also, for some reason, really like the scene, or scenes, where Liam Neeson's talking to the boy. Like I said, their relationship stood out. And anyway, that's a separate question, but... Hard to pin down. I can't recall what they were even exactly talking about, but Liam Neeson is being like very, very open and like talking about sex and stuff. And like, they're like laying on a couch or something, like with their heads next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just like a really heartwarming scene. I remember always like enjoying that, feeling very like, I don't know, moved by that, the sentiment of that scene for some reason. So I'll go with that one as well.
Yeah. Cynthia, favorite scene.
I think my favorite scene was when the prime minister was looking for Natalie. And before that, though, he goes to his kid's house or something, his nephew's house and nieces, and they say, "We hate Jamie." Yeah. Is that that?
Yeah. Those are two different scenes.
It's actually Colin. It's not the prime minister.
I hate Uncle Jamie.
Colin Firth, yeah.
Okay, erase. All right, then I got characters mixed up, but nonetheless, I like that scene. And I do like the scene when the prime minister gets to Natalie's house and they all have to go, you know, they're in a hurry and just their connection. And she runs down the stairs and, you know, that sets up that whole happy ending for them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Cynthia, for my favorite scene when he finally makes it to their house. But I especially like when they're like, he's like, take me to wherever, the dodgy end. And they get there. He's like, this is the longest street in the world. I don't know what house it is. And he starts knocking on doors and he goes to the three girls. And they're like, will you sing for us? And he's like, no. They're like, please, please, please. And he starts singing Good King Wenceslas, which is like a funny thing. Like no one would sing that in America, but maybe the British know the words to that. But then he like looks at his driver or whoever, and he starts singing and he's like such a good singer. He's just like, no. And then he like looks at him. He gives him this look like, what the fuck? You could sing? Oh, I love that part. It cracks me up every time. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's
a great part.
Okay, so now we can talk about our favorite storyline / character if you want. So, Byron, what's your favorite storyline?
Oh, favorite storyline is the father and son. Just, I sort of agree with Jimmy that it's just so touching. And it's like, I don't know. I also really resonate with that relationship. But my favorite character is Billy, the pop star. He's just so, like, every time, I could watch a whole movie with him, to be honest. Great acting, super funny. Yeah.
All right. Grace?
I think my favorite storyline is Hugh Grant and Natalie. It's just enjoyable and, like, lighthearted. But like still kind of poignant with the what's his name? Billy Bob Thornton character. So that's my favorite.
Okay. Daniel, favorite storyline?
Since I mentioned Rowan Atkinson for that, which one do I think is You know what? I'll go with the Laura Linney storyline. I think Laura Linney is good in this. I like that's heading towards being something more interesting than like the formulas of all the other storylines. So I could have watched more of that one. I'll go with Laura Linney's character.
Can I change mine?
Yeah. Go ahead, Grace.
I just want to change mine to the Portuguese maid one. I like that one more.
Okay.
It's just so weird, even though they can't speak to each other. I forgot about it, honestly.
Okay, Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of already said, but I'll go with the dad and son or stepdad and son storyline. I mean, yeah, Liam Neeson's character is very likable. I think he might be one of my favorite characters, which is weird. I didn't expect to say that, but when I think about it, it's like, yeah, he's a pretty good character. I guess I like him. But yeah.
I mean, like, it's Byron's hard to choice. Not like his character.
Yeah, he's very likable and just, you know, I don't think he has any like questionable moments in the movie, I don't think. Anyway, Byron's choice too. I can't remember the old guy's characters is probably like the best. Yeah. Like brings the most life to the movie just through the character and through the performance. Anyway, so yeah, that's a really good pick too. So I'm between those two, if that's okay.
Okay, Cynthia, favorite storyline?
It's got to be the Prime Minister and Natalie. Hugh Grant is wonderful in this movie. I mean, people compare him to Cary Grant, but he so surpasses that in this movie with being charming and funny and awkward and then discovers his own strength, you know, and determined and all those things. I love his performance, but it's also a very endearing, definitely Cinderella type story, you know, that I don't expect it to be real, played beautifully, by the lead actors. So that's my favorite.
Yeah, I agree with you, Cynthia. I think the Prime Minister storyline is probably my favorite. I mean, there's a lot of it in there too. So there's more of it that we get to see. And I do love the whole ending scene of him going around knocking on everyone's doors. And he sort of plays it off like he's just going around to say Merry Christmas to like his people, which is kind of funny. And then he ends up going to like the kids' play and he runs into his sister, the Emma Thompson character. I don't know. I think that storyline is very charming and endearing. And it also has a lot of my favorite moments in it as well. But yeah, favorite character, Billy Mack. He's like the funniest part of the whole movie. Bill Nye's the best. And I agree with you, Byron. I would watch a whole movie about Billy Mack.
Are you sure though? I mean, this is a character who probably has been in and out of years of heroin addiction, probably burned a lot of bridges and destroyed a lot of relationships. We don't have to think about that.
Well, no, but it wouldn't be about that. It would be about him's character now, like trying to not be addicted to heroin and just like being funny. Yeah, but it'd be funny if they did it right. It would be hilarious. All right. Okay, well, we already said a lot of our favorites and least favorites, but let's go ahead and just wrap it up with our final thoughts and letter grades. Anything you haven't said yet about this movie you want to share, and what grade would you give it? And I guess we'll start with Byron again.
I mean, I think we touched on a little bit of like how this movie is somewhat dated in the, 19 years it's been since it came out. But that being said, I still had a really good time rewatching it. For whatever reason, I just sort of kept putting off watching it for this podcast. But yesterday I was like, no, let's do it. And Bill Nye starts the movie off. So I forgot about that. And it was just like so funny right from the rip and so many good performances. The cast is, I feel like another thing that like makes this movie special is that they don't do a lot of these like A-list kick-ass casts, ensemble comedies anymore. They, you know, there's sort of here and there, but this is a really, really good one of those. So it's almost like an event in that aspect. You know, it was a huge collection of such great talent. So super funny. Does hit some, I think, some interesting thoughts on romance and different types of love.
some issues with the subject material, perhaps, but I'm still going to give this movie an A because it makes me laugh and it also gives you the feels. So there you go.
Wow. Byron's giving out an A. I mean, you've given out A's before, but it's a big one for you, I feel like.
I can change it to A minus if that's like more on brand.
No, no, give it whatever you want to give it. Yeah. All right, Grace.
I am in the same vein. I was going to go like a high B, like in the, you know, 89-88% bracket. I was also going to mention the ensemble factor of this. I love an ensemble cast. I love the Christopher Guest movies and even like the Royal Tenenbaums and all those Wes Anderson movies, the same troupe of actors. Even the way that the movie is set up, you just like, you could see the cast list, but you just get hit one after the other of faces that you recognize and know to be, you know, strong, strong performers, and everybody does a strong performance. I don't feel like there's any, aside from Keira Knightley, who I just have my own personal qualms about, there's no real weak link here that I can see. And even, you know, what may be the weakest storyline, the porn one, is still really clever. And, you know, I know it's not as funny as it was when we were kids, but it's a situation that we've never seen a love story blossom within, right? So it's inventive and it's very heartfelt. And I was just thinking about the title and just that it's called Love Actually kind of speaks to, you know, those different types of love with the brother or the manager, all those other things are actually love as well, or love that's been actualized. So it's a really good movie. I got a little sick of it for a while because it was like everybody's favorite. And so for that reason, I can't fully get behind giving it an A, but it's a classic. I liked it more than I thought I would when I rewatched it. And I think it's a great movie. So that's why I gave it a B.
All right, Daniel.
I don't know. It's not for me and not my cup of tea. Probably like a C plus.
That's all.
Do you want to expand on that?
it's just too optimistic and too like everything just perfectly works out for these people. It's just like here's some nice rich white people and things work out nicely for them. Like, okay.
Except for Emma Thompson is like, are they going to get divorced? And then I guess
it doesn't. There's enough that technically
there's a couple that like that, aren't super that, happy.
Couple but it's of still like lines, I mean. The whole world. It's just like, I don't know. Like the elements that are dated or whatever don't, and then like the porn storyline is like, well, I actually don't think that's porn. I think it's just a regular movie with a lot of sex scenes, but it's like that's not how that stuff is made. Like those people would be like professionals and it wouldn't be awkward and stuff. That's how people want to imagine that stuff happens, not how it actually does. But it's like, I don't know.
That's why we watch movies, Daniel. Oh, to remember,
he's entitled to his grade.
Maybe I'm taking it too seriously. Maybe I need to realize that it's all just like transparently fake. And like, the movie has a vision. I respect how shameless it is. Like, you know what? We're just going to the airport all the way inside security. Like, you know, we don't need to do anything different than the airport scene. We're gonna have like the biggest airport scene you've ever seen. And you know what? And it's hard to fuck up movies when you have like Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson on screen together. You know, when you have the right people, it's hard for it to be. It's not going to be like unwatchable. But my attitude is kind of like, eh. Like meh. Like, yeah. I'm glad I'm watching this like 20 years later. It's more interesting now because it's like a time capsule of the time, and I think that. That's kind of interesting. You see, like, you know, fashion choices and stuff and music choices and style choices of the time. And because, you know, pop culture history is something I love. It's one of my favorite things. So it's always interesting to see, like, you know, it's not necessarily a masterpiece, but this is an example of like what entertainment was at the time. You know, an example of like when star power was really running the movie industry. before, like, you know, and the, you know, celebrity in the time before social media was, that's a whole other tangent. We don't have time to go down, but you know, it's an interesting capsule of that.
Yeah, it's true.
I, you know, it's just not angsty enough for Daniel, I guess. I need a little more alienation.
Okay. Well, I still appreciate that we have a voice saying that on this episode mm-hmm. about this movie. And I'm not surprised that that's how you feel about it, Daniel.
Well, I'm glad I can say I've seen it. I'm glad that I can say I've seen it. Like, you know, thank you, Kelly.
Okay, Jimmy, you're up.
Yeah, you guys said a lot of things that I generally agree with. I am a little bit on the Daniel bandwagon of, like, you know, the super fantastical elements of it do sort of, like, rub me the wrong way, and, like, just kind of the rom-com thing. But it's also, like, if it was going to be as... because there are moments when it's really funny, and I would almost prefer that it just all be really funny. But I don't know. There have been times when I've viewed it, and I've really liked that it had that drama-comedy blend, and I really... the dramatic parts really, really got to me, and the funny parts were really, really funny. Something about this most recent viewing, it didn't really affect me that deeply. It was kind of like the funny parts were funny, the dramatic parts were sad. And there's, like Daniel pointed out and others have as well, there's just so much talent on screen that with a good, you know, good enough story and good enough writing, I mean, that guy definitely knows how to write. You know, these actors do really great things with it, but then it's just, you know, what is the tone of the movie overall? Like, the thing that it's going for is the ultimate Christmas rom-com. And that is just, it limits the level of appreciation I can get to with it for some reason, because it's just always trying to stay there in that Christmas rom-com thing. And I mean, and then when it does go to, like, the disturbed brother who needs his sister constantly to take care of him, it's like, it feels weird. And I guess that's, like, cool that they included that, but I don't know. So anyway, I'm trying to express my negative feelings because it's hard to pin them down, like, why I even have them. Because there's a lot of great things about the movie, like I said already, like, just the cast, the acting, the clever writing, the way the stories are or sometimes aren't woven together is, like, pretty well done, I think. Like, they don't all need to be super woven together, and, like, the rock star, old guy rock star guy, like, he is present throughout the whole movie in a way that somehow you just buy, even though he's not really connected to anything. So that works. So it's got a lot going for it. I think I end up at, like, a B. It's just got too much talent and too much good stuff going on to ignore. But it's not a movie I'm really excited about watching. I kind of was at one point, but it just doesn't hit the same anymore. So, yeah, that's where I'm at, B.
All right, Cynthia.
Well, I very much enjoyed this movie. And Jimmy, you nailed it on the head by talking just about just the sheer level and capacity of the talent, you know, that are on the screen. Such a good cast. I really like the movie. But, you know, I think in my mind, would this be in my top 10 movies? Like, that's all I could ever see for the rest of my life, you know? And I don't think so. Like, don't ask me what others I would, but I think it's so great. I'm going to give it, I'm where you were, Gracie, 89%, 88%, a high B plus. Yeah. And that's a real good movie too. That's a real good movie at that grade for me.
Yeah. So I definitely remember hearing about this movie, and like we said, it kind of got a cult following with, like, DVDs and everything. And I saw it a lot later than other people did. I can't remember the first time I finally watched it, but you know what? I want to say it might've even been in college with, like, my roommate, Jillian. I feel like she's the one that might've been like, you've never seen this, and, like, put it on. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyways, I liked it. I totally got why people liked it so much, but I didn't, like, love it you know, like people said, there were certain storylines, like the Colin thing. I was kind of like, this is weird. While Laura Linney is great and it's an interesting storyline they have in there, like I felt uncomfortable watching the Laura Linney stuff the first time I saw it. Now I know it's coming, so I know what to prepare myself for. And then I think like the second time I saw it, I was sort of just like not into how sad the Laura Linney and the Emma Thompson storylines made me feel. Because it's just that I don't like being sad. That's just how I am as a person, especially when I watch movies. But there's so many great things that make me happy about this movie too. And, you know, I felt the same way Grace did, even though I hadn't seen it that many times. I was so sick of hearing about it and people referencing it and people saying it's the best movie ever. I'm just like, it's not though. And so then we decided to do a podcast on it because Daniel and Cynthia had never seen it. And it is such a beloved Christmas film. Then when we watched it the other night, I honestly was kind of like not super looking forward to watching it in a way. But then Jimmy was like, we have to watch it. So we put it on, of course, a few nights ago. And I like really enjoyed it. I like probably this is the like most enjoyable viewing I've ever had of this film. And I think it's because it's like Christmas season now because we're done with Thanksgiving and we've already watched a couple other Christmas movies. And I think I was always looking at this movie as a rom-com. But then when you look at it through the lens of a Christmas film, like, which might sound like a stupid thing to say because we're doing this for a Christmas movie podcast, but like, and I know it's a Christmas film, but you know what I'm trying to say? Like, when you look at it through like the good feeling time of Christmas, and especially like the last shot we get of the Laura Linney character is her like bringing her brother like a Christmas scarf and a Christmas sweater, and she gives him this big hug. And I'm like, oh, that is Christmassy. And like, okay. And I was less angry at her character this time watching it. But yeah, I really, really enjoy it. Also, we didn't really talk about this scene. We've obviously have talked about how great Emma Thompson is in this. She's one of my favorite actors out there. But the scene when she just goes and cries in her bedroom to Joni Mitchell is like, she's such a good actress. Like that scene alone, I'm like, give her more awards, please. Give her all the awards. I didn't pick that as my favorite scene because it makes me too sad, but it's like one of the best scenes in the movie, like acting wise. So I just wanted to throw that out there. But yeah, I agree with mostly the consensus here. It's a good movie. It's not one of my favorites. But it hasn't been an annual watch for me, Christmas season wise. It might become that now, actually, because I looked at it through that new lens of like, and you know, Bill Nye's character is just amazing. And I love the ending. His is one of the last scenes too, before the big final airport scene where they all kind of come together. But the last scene where he goes to his manager and he's like, yeah, let's get pissed and watch porn, and his little giggle. Oh God, so funny. So I think I'll just give this a solid B as well. I'll give it a solid B.
You know, I didn't mention either that really amazing scene at the airport when it's the Beach Boys song and you're watching all the clips of all the people hugging each other, like the bookend, the beginning of the movie where they begin it with all the people hugging each other. That is a particularly powerful moment.
Shout
out. Yeah.
The main lyrics are, God only knows where I'd be without you. So the lyrics themselves just even add more poignancy.
Yeah, the whole movie is about love actually being all around us. If you like open your mind up to the conception of love and it being all of these different things and, you know, not just thinking of it. Which is also ironic with like the cutesy or like romantic stuff. But anyway, that song really does tie that theme together really well. And just like, if there's anybody that you can think that about, like, what would I be without you? You know, that's a important love, and it doesn't have to be romantic. It can be parental, sibling, all that stuff. Just anybody that your life would be different without, you know. Just think it's a great choice of a song for that moment to encapsulate the whole theme.
All right, well, it's still a great movie. If you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth a watch. Especially, like Daniel said, it's got such a staple in pop culture, especially with Christmas movies. I think the average here is a B, B plus maybe. I guess Daniel's C plus is maybe bringing it down to a B average. But there we have it. Love Actually, our third Christmas special. You know, it's funny, I didn't realize that it was 19 years. We could have done this next year as a big 20th anniversary thing. But Daniel said that Elf also came out the same year. So maybe we do Elf next year for its 20th anniversary. Yeah. Who knows?
That was on a bunch of our lists, I think.
Yeah. So. That's not set in stone. I'm just throwing that out there as an option. But anyways, everyone, thank you for stopping by and listening to us. If you haven't, again, if you haven't subscribed, please do that. And again, all we want for Christmas is for you to rate and review us. Even if it's bad, tell us how you really feel. How can we be better? Yes, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. After the New Year, keep your eye out for our Pixar podcast wrap-up episode, where we'll review kind of the whole Pixar catalog and what we thought about everything, our favorite and least favorite movies, the next. And then who knows? Who knows what we'll be after that? But have a wonderful holiday season with whoever your true love is in your life. And happy holidays.
Yeah. Ho, ho, ho.